Yes, you are, please. And the marshal can call the fourth matter on our calendar as we've been joined by Judge Connolly and Judge Sleater.
The next matter is Bryce Peterson for City of Richfield.
And counsel, I'll just make a few comments, and this is in part to give you a little time to settle in, but also to make sure that we're all on the same playing field. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Your matter is the fourth matter on our calendar today. We're looking forward to hearing the arguments in this case. And you should know that when you get to the podium, a couple of things. You probably already know this, but I'm just going to say it to remind you. Please identify yourselves for the record. So that means by name as well as your client, and that we do that to keep our oral record really clear. And then secondly, please take whatever time you need to adjust the podium. We are looking forward to the conversation. We want to make sure you have the materials you need to answer questions, as well as just adjust that microphone and the level of the podium so you're comfortable. So counsel for appellant, we're ready when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Charlie Alden, and I'm the attorney for Greg Peterson, and was also counsel at his trial that's resulted in this appeal. And as I'm sure the members of this panel are aware of, Mr. Peterson has been to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on several occasions, and it was in March of 2016 that the Court of Appeals reversed the Hennepin County Court's grant of summary judgment on his second employment discrimination claim, which he ultimately won. And then shortly after that, as you've seen in the briefing, the city started to send him letters and ultimately terminated him. The point that I'd like to make is that Mr. Peterson, because of his multiple lawsuits, including on other issues aside from just summary judgment, which the Court of Appeals has granted in his favor, he had become a target for the City of Richfield. But more importantly, the City of Richfield had gained extensive experience in papering the file and trying to come up with legitimate, purported, non-discriminatory reasons to terminate Officer Peterson. And that's why this case, as you saw in the briefing, became entirely about pretext. And it was something that the district court judge recognized on many occasions. She granted, or rather denied, the City of Richfield's motion for summary judgment explicitly on pretext grounds. And then she denied the City of Richfield's motion for a directed verdict explicitly on pretext grounds. And she says on the record, the district court judge, as the evidence came in, I found myself thinking about the McDonnell-Douglas analysis and how if an employer's version of events is unworthy of credence and cannot be believed, we're allowed to infer the existence of a retaliatory motive. And then, as you saw, the district court judge denied the jury the ability to receive a pretext instruction, and therefore she overrode her own law of the case.
As long as you're on a roll in terms of following the district court's analysis, I think the district court perhaps did have it right in the post-trial decision in that, on page 4 of that decision, the judge said no one disputes that the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting construct, which enshrines the pretext concept, is regularly applied by Minnesota courts. And then she specifically goes back to what you just said, which is the court used that on summary judgment. Trial judge then went on to say the narrow issue in plaintiff's motion is whether failing to include a pretext instruction along with the motivating factor instruction that was given was error warranting. Do you agree that that's the narrow issue?
I do agree that that's the issue, and I think that the Court of Appeals in McGrath 1, which we discuss in our brief, the interesting thing about McGrath 1, the Court of Appeals decision, the intermediate decision, is that in that case, a motivating factor instruction was provided to the jury, and then the Court of Appeals took it up, and instead of saying we're going to reinstate the jury verdict because there was a motivating factor instruction and that's sufficient, instead agreed that the case had to be remanded to the trial court with both the pretext instruction and the quote-unquote cumulative statements found in Sigurdsson and Anderson. So I think that's a principle.
There's a big difference between remanding a case for a new trial on the pretext instruction, as was done in McGrath, obviously as modified by the Supreme Court. We did have that Supreme Court modification. And what you're asking us to do today, which is saying that basically, as a matter of law, a pretext instruction must be given in every reprisal case.
Well, I don't think necessarily that, number one, I think that McGrath 1 and the Supreme Court's modification does stand for the proposition that a pretext instruction must be given to the jury so they can adequately understand the law.
In every case? Is that how you would state the rule from McGrath?
Well, that is absolutely how I would state the rule in McGrath, because
I just don't see that language in the case. Just to be honest with you, counsel, I'm not seeing it, so help me out.
Okay, well, I guess that's what the McGrath opinion says. It doesn't explicitly say in every case, I agree, but it doesn't say, nor does it say it's on a case-by-case basis. It said in McGrath a pretext instruction was required, and I don't see how that controlling precedent doesn't also apply in this case. And on the question, Your Honor, I would even entertain the concept that perhaps it is correct for pretext instructions to be granted on a case-by-case basis if the evidence warrants it. And that is the principle considered in the Eighth Circuit case, where the Eighth Circuit said that in some situations, we don't presume this to apply in every single case, that a pretext instruction is necessary in every single case. But in some cases, this is the Moore decision, of course, in some cases, the evidence might give rise to the necessity for a pretext instruction.
Well, I'd like to back up just a little bit, counsel, instead of jumping right to what Moore and mm-hmm. McGrath say about pretext, to focus a little bit on what the jury did receive mm-hmm. as their statement of the law in this case, because they were instructed on motivating factor. And mm-hmm. in fact, that was the question on the verdict form. So if I read your brief correctly, and I might not, so tell me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that you do not contend that the district court incorrectly charged the jury on motivating factor.
We didn't brief that the motivating factor instruction was incorrect, but
you're saying it's incomplete because we're missing pretext, right?
Yeah, and I don't even think it's quibbling over it being incomplete. Since 1973, the Supreme Court has said that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that you need to follow this three-step analysis in McDonnell Douglas, and I have an issue with.
But the Minnesota Supreme Court's never come out and said that a district court, when trying to a case to a jury, must instruct that jury on all steps of the McDonnell Douglas analysis.
Well, they affirmed the Court of Appeals decision in McGrath, and that's what the Court of Appeals held in McGrath.
Affirmed it with modification, and they're pretty clear in that modification that they're talking about a specific footnote.
Holden, can I?
Please.
Would it be a better clarification that you look at all these decisions, and I was looking at Anderson just in following this line, specifically did not require or suggested we're not requiring a strict application of the McDonnell Douglas analysis. When you take that with all the decisions, would it be better to say that it's error not to consider the three steps of McDonnell Douglas? And so the real issue is here, and that maybe gets to the point respondents making in terms of the arguments that were made to the jury, because wouldn't it be true in all scenarios here where it's clear that the jury was instructed that you can have basically a proper purpose as well as the improper purpose and still find for your client? In effect, isn't that what all cases when a jury makes a credibility determination, they are inherently making a pretextual process decision, because the arguments were made by your client here was the improper purpose, the city then made the arguments, all the proper purposes they chose for the city. Isn't that in effect that what the pretext element, the prong requires?
I think it's quite a stretch to assume, and there's wonderful language in the Federal Circuit Court opinions, as well as the Iowa Supreme Court case DeBoom versus Raining Rose from 2009, that helps to understand that part of what the pretext instruction does is allows a jury to find as a preponderance of the evidence by making an inference an argument that's unworthy of credence. This is turning into a very long sentence. But the point is that the pretext instruction helps the jury satisfy the burden of proof of preponderance of the evidence. And In employment discrimination cases and in reprisal cases and in McGrath, which was a whistleblower case, employers never come out and say the reason we're firing you, as in Officer Peterson's case, is because you've become a thorn in our side and we want to fire you a couple months before your November of 2016 trial and get rid of you. That's why you prove these cases through circumstantial evidence, because the employer is never going to make it explicit. If they did, the case would probably be settled. And on top of that, it's easier to rely principally on a motivating factor instruction when the employer has actually supplied direct evidence of discrimination. If the employer, for instance, said in an email, we need to get rid of Officer Peterson, well, in that case, the pretext instruction is not in place to do the work that it's intended to do, because you can see that his prior lawsuit was a motivating factor. What pretext allows you to do is say, you can use this as an inference of an improper motive if you don't believe what the city is saying. Because when you're relying on circumstantial evidence, you need the jury to be able to fill in that gap. And in that 2009 Iowa Supreme Court case, DeBoom v. Raining Rose, they use some really good language saying that a reason that's unworthy of credence becomes, quote, affirmative evidence of guilt. And that's the point in a case like this, is that the employer is never going to admit that they terminated the plaintiff for an improper reason, for their use of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to bring a couple of lawsuits. And when an employer doesn't come out and say that, you need to give the jury a tool under McDonnell Douglas to say, we're going to infer the existence of an improper motive because the pretext instruction tells us to.
Well, why, Mr. Alden, looking at the instructions that were given, this last sentence, an employer can be found liable if an employee shows that one factor motivating the decision to terminate is driven by discriminatory or retaliatory intent. I mean, doesn't that sort of get a little bit as to what you want them to do, which is to figure out, well, ignore what they're saying they are firing you for, but really focus on what really is going on, and why isn't that good enough?
Because the third step of the McDonnell Douglas analysis requires a finder of fact to determine whether those reasons are pretextual. And the language from the federal courts that have discussed this, where they say that a pretext instruction is necessary because this three-step analysis has stymied even the ablest of federal judges. And when you go into a closing argument, and it's a wholly different thing, Your Honor, to say that they must have been motivated by his prior lawsuit than to be able to say, the judge will give you a pretext instruction that says if you don't believe what they're telling you, you're permitted to infer the existence of a retaliatory motive. And here, you know, there's a I think it's the Fifth Circuit case, Townsend versus Lumberman's Mutual, where summary judgment was reversed by the Court of Appeals based on pretext, and then the judge didn't give a pretext instruction. And the Court of Appeals said, it defies logic that we would reverse this based on pretext, the law of pretext, and then the trial court would refuse to even instruct the jury. And the same is true here. You know, the district court denied the city's motion for summary judgment and their motion for a directed verdict based only on the evidence of pretext. This was the law of the case. We weren't going in and arguing only motivating factor. We were trying to disprove everything that the city said. And the problem that federal courts and the Iowa Supreme Court have identified, and also our Court of Appeals in McGrath, is that without telling the jury what they're permitted to do if they disbelieve every reason advanced by the employer, the jury could still disbelieve every reason advanced by the employer, but they don't know that they're allowed to use that disbelief as affirmative evidence for plaintiff to support their burden of proof.
So, counsel, because your time is going quickly, and you may need to want to respond to this in rebuttal, so I just want to ask it of you now, and we'll see how far you get. So let's say we agree with you on the first part of your analysis and that Minnesota law does require a pretext instruction. You still wouldn't prevail in this appeal unless you go to a second prong, which is to show prejudice for the failure to give it. And I'm troubled because you didn't provide the court with a complete transcript of this case. And normally our scope, first of all, it's your duty to do that. It's not respondent's duty under our rules and under our case law. And then secondly, when you fail to do that, it does circumscribe our review. We have many cases saying that. So how do we even reach prejudicial effect?
Well, the city did not argue that there's a sufficiency of evidence issue. And if they believe...
It isn't about sufficiency. It's about prejudice.
Well, we did order the parts of the transcript that are important. And the closing argument is the place where we would have argued pretext. And as well as the part of the...
You did argue pretext in the closing argument. There are multiple references to pretext. What I'm talking about is the evidence in the case. We really have to take your word that the evidence in the case supports a pretext instruction because we don't have the transcript.
Well, as I mentioned in my brief, if the city of Richfield, who's responsible to advance that argument, had thought that an entire trial transcript was necessary, they could have requested by motion that we order one. But this is a narrow issue. In our view, this is a narrow issue about just whether a pretext instruction is required. And you can see from the remaining documents in the record, we know what this case is about. You can see it from the summary judgment motion, from the motion for a directed verdict. There's no need here to provide a trial transcript to show what these facts are. The facts are what they are. And the judge's own words.
You know, and your time's finished, so yeah. I'll just leave you this with one last question that I have, and it may be only me, so perhaps you need to devote a little time to it in your rebuttal. But yeah, are there any other cases where this court has reversed and remanded for a new trial where we didn't have the benefit, finding prejudicial effect, you know, to an erroneous jury instruction, where we didn't have the benefit of a transcript? If you just...
Sure, I think we cite some in our brief.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Fleming Wolf, and I represent the city of Richfield in this matter. In this case, your honors, the trial court denied Mr. Peterson's motion for a new trial because the jury instructions as a whole correctly informed the jury of the law applicable to retaliatory discharge claims in Minnesota. And he failed to establish that he was prejudiced by the non-inclusion of his proposed pretext instruction. Now, I was going to start by...
The court did give the instruction that Mr. Alden requested and you lost. Would you be able to argue that that was an error? By giving it?
Yeah. If we had asked for a pretext instruction and it had been denied, we probably could have argued that, but I wouldn't have because it's not necessary in the case. So we didn't
have. And also probably would have been a loser.
Yes.
I mean, we are reviewing this under abuse of discretion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the court wanted to give the pretext instruction based on the arguments Mr. Alden is making, the court could have done that. But the issue is because it didn't, even though it was requested, whether that was error.
Right.
How do you read the, if I pronounce this correctly, the McGrath cases in terms of requiring a pretext instruction or not?
Yeah. I want to say before I address that, the first to address something you said before so I don't forget, and that is there is a distinction in this case between what a pretext instruction that courts have used is, a proper pretext instruction, and the one that plaintiff proposed. So if the court would have adopted this instruction, we might have had a basis for objecting because it wasn't really a definition of pretext. It went way further than that. But and actually addressing what McGrath says.
So it was a little different from the standard Fed jig?
Oh, it was quite different,
Well, just to be specific, counsel, I think the proposed instruction varied from the federal circuit instruction in what, the second paragraph?
Yes, in the explaining how a plaintiff, well, it's exactly what the plaintiff is arguing, Your Honor.
But that wasn't the district court's reason for not giving it.
No.
The district court didn't parse it out. So I'm looking at page 3 of the district court's post-trial order, and you know, the district court just denies it, doesn't parse it about
right.
what parts of it are proper or improper.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The she says it's not necessary. Well, she explains why, but also in her comments, brief comments, on the record for denying it, she does say that the instructions that were proposed that the plaintiff wanted that she was denying were unnecessary and misleading. And I would say that those two remarks are certainly applicable to the proposed instruction. But getting to the question of what did McGrath do? So in McGrath 1, the Court of Appeals held that the failure to give a pretext instruction was so prejudicial to the employer, based on a review of the transcript of the trial and the evidence submitted, that it required remand for a new trial. The court stated that in McGrath 1, that the motivating factor instruction, which instructed the jury to find TCF liable if McGrath's discharge was motivated in whole or in part by his protected conduct, improperly, that instruction alone improperly favored the employee and was given an error because it did not require the jury to determine whether the reasons for McGrath's discharge offered by TCF were pretextual. In a footnote, and this is why the Supreme Court took it up on a petition for review for the narrow issue that it did, in a footnote, the Court of Appeals criticized the McDonnell-Douglas analysis as it's been applied, as they saw it was applied in Minnesota, because it required the fact finder to determine whether a proffered non-discriminatory reason for the discharge was pretextual, rather than to specifically determine whether the alleged discriminatory reason was one of the reasons for the discharge. And the court went further and said, if there are two reasons for discharge and one of the reasons is non-discriminatory, when asked to determine whether the non-discriminatory reason claimed by the employer is pretextual, the fact finder could conclude that it is not, and there would be no liability even if the other reason for the discharge was discriminatory. And the Court of Appeals lamented further that this was not what the MHRA, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, was designed to address. The Minnesota Supreme Court accepted review for the sole purpose of clearing up that misstatement of what the McDonnell-Douglas method of proof.
Does that mean, Ms. Fleming, the point that the appellant's making is that obviously the Supreme Court then implicitly at least agreed or did not reverse the decision that the Court of Appeals made that it was error not to have the pretext instruction? So that remained the case, and they could have, and that's part of the point appellant makes, that if that was an error to require it, they simply could have undone that and right. reinstated.
Well, it's possible that the Supreme Court could have addressed it directly, but it didn't at all address pretext or whether that part, it didn't accept that part of the petition for review. It addressed only the inaccurate analysis of what is required for the motivating factor instruction in a retaliatory, or in this case, in McGrath, in a discrimination case, that it's not, the jury should be instructed that the Supreme Court said the proper standard, as expressed in Sigurdsson and Anderson, was that the plaintiff can prevail if an illegitimate reason, more likely than not, motivated the discharge decision. So it's not enough do what the Court of Appeals said was the instruction that should have been given. It's not enough to just show that the reasons are pretextual. You have to show that one of the reasons was a retaliatory motive in our case.
Well, my last point, though, wouldn't you agree that going back to Sigurdsson and Anderson and through McGrath, the prudent thing for a trial judge to do is indeed, since we got three factors, is to have an instruction related to pretext. Your separate argument is perhaps the wording of that. So would you agree that it's fair for the court to not give that instruction at all?
No. No, I, with all due respect, I would not agree, because that is not what Minnesota law requires. That's not what McGrath 1 does not hold that a pretext instruction must be given in every case. And what McGrath 1 does at most is to say, in this case, based on this record, the jury should have been instructed that they were required to show that the reasons given by TCF were pretextual. They also have to show that one of the reasons was retaliation, just one. But they had to also show that the reasons were pretextual. It doesn't define what pretextual means, and plaintiff's instruction, proposed instruction, did not suggest that, the jury must find, and the plaintiff was not required to prove, that the reasons the city gave were pretextual. The jury wasn't informed of that. All the plaintiff had to do in this case was to show that one factor, even if all of the other reasons were true and made sense and similarly situated people were treated the same, all the plaintiff had to do in this case was to show that their one factor was a retaliatory motive. And I guess that gets into the failure to establish prejudice in this case, because had the court adopted the instruction or the requirement the McGrath 1 court said in 1986, I believe it was, that had to be given, the instruction that had to be given in that case, he would have had a more difficult burden, because he would have had to have shown, been required to show, that the reasons the city gave were, in fact, a pretext for discrimination, retaliation, that they were false, or that all of the arguments that he was giving, that all of the circumstantial evidence that he proposed and provided to the jury showed was, in fact, true. They would have had to agree with him, for example, that the plaintiff was treated differently than another employee. They obviously didn't. And, I mean, I think it is telling that, well, two things. One is the Reeves case that plaintiff relies on says that circumstantial evidence is one way of showing pretext. You don't have to do it directly. You can do it through circumstantial evidence. The court in this case, of course, gave an instruction to the jury that the plaintiff did not have to prove his case through direct evidence, that he could prove it through circumstantial evidence. He argued in his closing that there was circumstantial evidence that showed that retaliation was a motivating factor. He argued in his closing, in addition, what that evidence was, in his opinion, and he also argued that the jury, or he told the jury, you don't have to agree with me that this is the correct view of the evidence presented. You could agree with the city and believe the city, and then you should find for the city. So to the extent this record is sufficient for review of this issue, which I would submit is absolutely not, to determine prejudice, because we don't have a transcript of the evidence and testimony, and I am not aware of any case in which a case has been remanded for trial, and I don't believe any of the cases cited in plaintiff's brief do that, when a review of the evidence did not support that there was prejudice. That's how the court reviews it, to determine whether there's prejudice, not based on the argument of counsel.
As I hear the argument from appellant's counsel, they're saying that to the extent you want to make the argument that there's no prejudice, then the onus shifted to the respondent to order the transcript.
Right, but it's not our burden to prove prejudice. Of course, it's his obligation, it's the appellant's obligation to show not only that there was an error of law by not including a pretext instruction, even though Minnesota law clearly does not require it, only, but also to show that that failure was prejudicial and that the trial court abused its discretion in determining that it wasn't prejudicial for the reasons that she stated, which were that he was free to argue pretext in his closing argument and did, and that the jury instructions that were given correctly stated the law on the burdens of proof.
But of course there is that other instruction, which I assume was made here, that the judge gives, is that what the attorneys say is not the law, what I say is the law. I mean, wouldn't that be sort of the response to, sure, I can say it in closing argument, but if the judge is saying ignore them when they talk about the law, I mean,
right,
probably going to do that.
Well, I would submit the instruction does not say ignore them when they talk about the law. What it says is, which is what the plaintiff says.
I apologize. I haven't been giving these instructions in 10 years, so yeah. I'm sure you and Mr. Alden know them better than
I
do.
What it says is if what the lawyers say is different than what I say about the law. But the judge gave no instruction on pretext, so there wasn't any inconsistency. And there wasn't any objection by me or correction by the judge made to his statements about what pretext was. Your Honors, I don't have anything further. If there are no further questions, I would simply ask that the court affirm the trial court's denial of the motion for a new trial in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. So just to first address, Your Honor, your question about the prejudice argument. So I haven't looked specifically to that point, and because we didn't brief it. The city's argument with respect to it not being prejudicial, I think the city is arguing that it wasn't prejudicial to not give a pretext instruction, but they're arguing that for a different reason, because the city is saying that the other cumulative instructions, they're arguing it from a legal position, which is the same way we are, that they're saying the cumulative other instructions like circumstantial evidence and motivating factor, that those fill in for the absent pretext instruction. And I think that rather than go through the entire 5-day trial, I think that what we can do here is look at the judge's own statements in denying the city's motion for a directed verdict, and also in her summary judgment order, but more importantly in the directed verdict denial, she lists what the evidence is. She compares the two officers. She compares Peterson in 2005 when he was given a tremendous amount of time off to Peterson in 2016 when he was fired. But the point is that the judge understood the law. The judge knew that this was a pretext case. And in some respects, we went along with her from summary judgment through the denial of a motion for directed verdict. And then after saying that there's no case that relies more explicitly on pretext evidence, the judge fails to instruct the jury on the third prong of McDonnell-Douglas. And to that point, you know, mentioning pretext in closing arguments, the word was said 4 times. Pretext is not, if you go ask somebody on the street what pretext means, chances are they're not going to know what the word means. 100% guarantee they're not going to know its legal effect. And I love the language from the Fifth Circuit.
You know, counsel, I guess I'm a little struck by that argument that it's not common knowledge, and yet plaintiff's counsel chose to use it in closing argument. I mean, you could have simply said that the city's lying about the reason that mm-hmm. they used to terminate Mr. Peterson. Just said, they're lying. It's not really that. It's as the judge did instruct the jury that Mr. Peterson was terminated in retaliation for his age discrimination and other lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all they needed to say. They didn't need to. There's no magic to the word pretext, is there?
Yes, there is magic to the word pretext.
In the law there is, but to the jury. You just told me the jury doesn't understand the word pretext. So
why
do we have to instruct them on it?
We have to instruct them on it, as I was about to say, so the timing of your question was excellent. I just can't disagree with these statements from the Federal Circuit that it's an error not to instruct the jury on a principle of law that is so difficult that it has stymied the ablest of federal and even state court judges in the state of Minnesota. it pretext and the concept becomes old hat to employment lawyers and perhaps to judges, but there's been a three-step analysis that needs to be followed since 1973. And a jury given 32 instructions, to expect them to apply the law that they don't know, that is a difficult legal concept, is going to hamstring any plaintiff's employment law counsel. So you can say the word pretext, but it's a whole different thing to say, and this is what your jury instruction will tell you. You go into that deliberation room and you read this jury instruction. The city has not admitted any discriminatory reason for terminating Officer Peterson, but what the judge is going to tell you is if you disbelieve everything that the city has told you, which the judge acknowledged she disbelieved it, I mean, take a look at that if you haven't already, but it's a whole different thing to say that's where your evidence comes from, because you can then infer the existence of an illegitimate reason for terminating the plaintiff. And we presume that the juries read and understand the law, and as Your Honor pointed out, the judge instructs the jury to say disregard what the lawyers tell you is the law, and of course, plaintiff's counsel in this case did not argue contrary to the jury instructions, did not spell out what pretext does and how it allows you to infer the existence of a discriminatory motive, because that would have been flouting the trial judge's order. So the point being that this is a difficult concept for jurors to understand, and the power of a jury instruction is what allows them to reach the correct law. That's my time.
Thank you, counsel. I want to extend gratitude to the entire panel. This matter was well-briefed and well-argued. It's now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame.
It was nice to see you again, Ms. Fleming.